Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm joined by my good friend and confidant, Renee Vassilos. Hey, Renee, how you doing?
Hi, Aaron. It's great to be here. Not in our usual studio, but wonderful to see you.
It is wonderful to see you as well, and not in our original studio. Yes, we normally record in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but like most, we have allocated ourselves from our home offices to have an engaging conversation today, and I'm excited for today's conversation.
I am so excited for today's conversation. All right.
All right. And I'm
can't
sure
wait.
We'll have plenty of this talking over one another, just like everybody else does on Zoom. It is a normal practice. We're all getting used to the cadence. So I trust we can do this. We're good to go. Hey, Renee, a little bit about your background, and then we'll jump into today's conversation. Renee Vassilos is a Dutch-American agricultural economist who has spent over 15 years in production agricultural space. Her work and experience includes time spent with the USDA. She has started her own consulting company that works to help investors and agritech companies, and she spent over a decade with John Deere, with much of that time in Beijing. Last year, Renee joined the Nature Conservancy as their Agricultural Innovation Director. She manages the TNC's investment in early-stage ag tech companies that will support regenerative agricultural production at scale. Welcome, Renee. Good stuff. Hey, Renee, what is going on? Now that we've been stuck in home offices for 6 to 8 weeks, how have you been able to work with these early-stage companies in the ag tech space, help them continue to push the envelope, and to look at when we do get out of this area of captivity, that we'll have to move forward even with more cadence, more pace? What can we learn from this?
Well, the good news is agriculture work goes on. So a lot of the early stage companies that had trials planned, much of that work continues, obviously with appropriate social distancing. But good news is that a lot of early stage companies are just keeping on with their plans in terms of piloting and trialing their solutions. And then the other important piece is that the agriculture space is so international. And the idea that you'd be connecting virtually at all hours and times of the day is not new. So that's also been kind of a benefit. We were set up for this. So it's moving along. We are seeing, you know, of course, some caution in terms of investments, but or I should say the pace of investments, not total caution, just maybe a slowing of pace. But the interest and awareness of the importance of agriculture, I think, is just growing literally by the week.
It's fascinating too, because what we've seen is this elevation of producers of food and folks that are sourcing food and purveyors of food as being essential workers. And maybe we needed something like this to see it in a different way, for more people to be aware that food just doesn't show up at the grocery store, that it actually takes significant amount of work, commitment, efforts to actually produce this volumes of food that we just treat as not even a commodity.
Absolutely. It's unfortunate how we got here, but we're here now. And you're absolutely right, Aaron. The awareness, even just for my community that isn't necessarily agriculture focused, it's been pretty incredible. And I hope our memories are long for this, because you're right, it's a very important time.
All right. Well, for today's episode, we originally had this slated for April 22nd, Earth Day of 2020, right? And we were going to record, as we talked about, in the Cambridge studio. And it was, we are acclimating. We're rolling with it. We've gone virtual. And what will be unique for our listening audience is the sound quality may not be the same as what we're used to on the podcast. But the good news is, we'll be having a video recording along with the launch of a YouTube channel, which will allow us to not only hear the voices, but see all of the great body language that we put into our in-depth and heated conversations sometimes, right? Right, Renee? That's kind of what we're going with here. So as we all, again, are stuck in our home offices, is a good chance to see what's going on behind the scenes. And so, you know, I'd say that the key for us and what we continue to focus on, the problems at hand on the shrinking planet, is the approach that we try to take is addressing those problems, but through the solutions of change. And all of our 96 guests in the past and today's guest, I think are front and center, are essential for us to have a true and better understanding that we can wallow in the problems and the perils. And that's been done through volumes of documentaries, but ultimately we do not move forward until we really start to look at these as solutions of change and following the lead of people that are casting a new future. So for today's show, we'll explore the potential of the lifeblood of this change. And maybe it's the only engine with the capacity to drive change with a quick enough pace to stabilize the planet. For episode 97, we'll explore reimagining capitalism in a world on fire with professor and author Rebecca Henderson. Hi, Rebecca. How are you doing today?
Aaron, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
It is our pleasure. It's always nice to see another native or near Bostonian close by in Cambridge, right down the street. Again, we're doing this virtually, but nonetheless, it's always fun to have these conversations. And I think, you know, our precursor to the show, we realized we actually are not too far away. We're stone's throw away. So we're supporting each other's cause here as we move forward. So Professor Henderson, I want to start by talking a bit of your work. And I do want to talk and explore the launch of your new book and also your work at Harvard Business School. But I recently heard economist Paul Krugman describe the current state of COVID-19 lockdown as putting the economy in a medical-induced coma. That was an interesting way of framing it. And so from your point of view, is this an opportunity for us to reimagine and to regenerate capitalism with this capacity to rebuild out of this current state of affairs? And should we embrace this notion that we should never let a good crisis go to waste?
Absolutely. This is the moment to accelerate the conversation about reimagining capitalism. COVID has made clear the very real fault lines in our system. They were evident before, but the crisis has really put them front and center. The most obviously by highlighting the role of people whom up until quite recently we were just assuming would show up and now turn out to be essential workers. And whoa, they don't have healthcare. They don't have savings that would enable them to step away from their jobs if it's dangerous. They have to come to work no matter what. And if they get sick, they're particularly vulnerable. I think accelerating inequality was very much in view before the crisis, but COVID has put a really human face on it. The fact that deaths are disproportionately among minority groups, for example. The fact that we are asking people to whom we were barely paying a living wage to put their lives on the line to keep us safe and well is a huge thing. Before the crisis hit, I would talk about the problems in capitalism. I would talk about climate change and the risks that posed to the planet and to our food systems. I would talk about our inequality, and I would sort of talk about it in, everybody got climate. Everyone could see that destabilizing the planet's climate was a bad idea. But when I got to inequality, a lot of business people would say, you know, yes, it's an issue. It's not really my thing. Don't really bother me. And that has really changed. When I'm in conversation now, people can see that inequality is our problem, that it's a systemic problem, and that maybe business has a very important role to play in addressing it. So yes, the groups I'm talking to are so much more open to this, let's think about how we build back better idea. It's really exciting. At the same time, it's really tragic, right? I mean, the fact that it took a crisis of this magnitude to get us pay attention to these issues, I mean, it is what it is, but it's heartbreaking in many ways.
So, Renee, I want to turn it over to you. I know you have a few questions stacked up for Rebecca, but just a continuation question of that, Rebecca. You've just launched your book, Reimagining Capitalism in a World on Fire, which borrows upon, I think, a name of a course you teach at Harvard Business School. So how has that book been received? And this is, I know you're doing a virtual book tour with the launch of the book. And with that, what has been the most surprising learning experience in this whole process?
So I'll be straight with you. When I realized I was going to be launching the book into the middle of a pandemic, I was like, oh dear, really don't want to do this. So I've been just honored and delighted that the book so far has been received really quite well. It was one of the Financial Times' Book of the Week this week, so that's super exciting. I'll be on MSNBC this weekend. But you know what really makes me excited is that people who read the book like it and say they find it useful and that it speaks to the moment we're in. I mean, that's the feedback I really treasure, that this book might be helpful to the thousands of people that are trying to take us to a better, juster, more sustainable capitalism.
I think there's tremendous application for what you've written for the agriculture industry. In fact, besides fossil fuel industry, I think there's no other industry besides agriculture that's more acutely aware that business as usual just can't continue. And many of the critical factors that you outline in the book are very much front and center in agriculture. The agriculture industry is very close to the impacts of pushing environmental limits. And we're starting to see that as soil degradation is causing the cost to produce the same amounts to continue to rise. And the increasing volatility from climate change is also really challenging production. And then also farm economics are very stressed. There is a lot of financial incentives for farmers to pay attention and question the status quo. And then, of course, it's a very long-term industry. Farmers are working the land, and so they're in this for the long haul. And so that incentive is also there. And then the agriculture industry has a history of being politically engaged. So that is something that already exists. While we might think there's some room to continue to drive some changes there, the practice exists. And in fact, Sonny Perdue broke ranks recently, he's the Secretary of Agriculture, to promote carbon pricing, which was almost certainly driven by farmer demand and is a very interesting a turn of events. And then also we have a race to the top already occurring with some of the consumer-facing food companies. You highlighted Unilever twice in the book with tremendous examples around palm oil and sustainable tea. So the question I have for you is, how do we imagine that we can engage the supply side of the equation? So the farmer-facing side of the equation, the seed companies, the fertilizer companies, the chemical companies, equipment companies, the processors, and the traders to join this race to the top?
I think about the moment we're facing as a Kodak moment, that this is the world's Kodak moment. And I think that's the way to frame it for the supply side. Let me give you a sense of what I mean. So I spent the first 20 years of my life teaching innovation at MIT, at MIT's business school. And I was the Eastman Kodak professor of management during that time. That was deeply ironic because that's what I did. What was Kodak? It was a company that in its time was amongst the most profitable companies ever seen. People said of Kodak, there was nothing more profitable that was legal. They invented commercial photography. They had a brand that was known everywhere around the world. The world rained money on them. And then the world shifted to digital photography. And what happened to Kodak? It went bankrupt. Now, I think it's just coincidence that that's the year I moved from MIT to Harvard, but that issue is what I've spent my career studying, is the fact that so many firms see that the world is changing and don't move. I spent a year of my life trying to persuade Nokia. Remember them? At one time, they made a million cell phones a week. I tried to persuade Nokia that Apple was something they should pay attention to, and didn't do terribly well. So when I say we're in the middle of a Kodak moment right now, what I mean is that we know the world must shift, particularly, Renee, as you said, in agriculture. It's front and center that we have to make this shift, that the long-term effects on climate change, on the water cycles, we're going to see droughts and floods, is completely untenable. We're going to see millions of people forced off their land because they can't grow the food that they need. We're going to see major instabilities in our own food supply. We know that's happening. We're like Kodak. We're sitting there. We can see, as it were, digital photography coming towards us, and we're all like, ah, what are we going to do? This is tough. So it's absolutely tough. Why is it hard? Because this is a collective action problem. Everybody has to move. If a few people continue to farm in the old ways, if most people continue to burn fossil fuels as if there's no tomorrow, we're not going to make the progress we need. So I think the answer is twofold. One, to use something like the Kodak metaphor to try and bring some urgency and the sense of inevitability to it. And secondly, to support in every way we can firms and farmers acting together to address this problem. So if everybody moves together, nobody's at a competitive disadvantage. And if we can persuade the broader world to act against climate change, and I think the agricultural sector is perhaps ideally situated to try and make real the idea that we really need to address these issues, if we can persuade everyone to move away from fossil fuels, then I think now we're really making progress. But that's the sort of overview of how I think about this problem. It's a Kodak moment. Everybody has to work together.
Renee, I don't know if you have a follow-up question. I just want to state that I have one of those Nokia 8600 phones, the T9, you know, the old text version. I also have the BlackBerry Bold version. So I was kind of early to those days of seeing those innovations evolution. It's interesting to see it now from what we get used to of innovation and that perspective of ingenuity put at Moore's Law, right? When now we're doing it at expedited rates, but now we're dealing with that adoption of incredibly large systems types thinking. Or we're talking about agricultural systems, or water systems, we're talking about changing of people's perspectives of even looking at food as a mechanism of preventative health. So are there economic models that we can study or that we can assess? Are there examples from the case studies you work with large organizations where they're able to trigger those types of price sensitivity or perspectives or inducing values into a buy decision of their consumer that are on a macro level that allow people to start to bridge that understanding that it's not just about price points and getting the cheapest product at the quickest pace, but you know, there are more variables that come into play in the buy decision and what that really can represent for the future of free markets.
There are so many examples, I'm not sure where to start. The idea that something was a commodity, but now we're going to make it a differentiated product or a differentiated service, I think tells you roughly the history of innovation in the last 20 years. I mean, most obviously, let me start with retail stores and grocery stores in particular. For a long time, we were looking at much of grocery as pile it high and sell it cheap. And that has become untenable over the last 5-6 years. We've got people coming in right at the bottom, selling it really cheap. And we've got people right at the high end selling you, you know, the handcrafted leg of lamb from wherever. And I think we're seeing more and more stores try and create experiences, places to gather. Bookstores would be another example. It's not a bookstore, it's a gathering place. It's a place you go to connect to community. Books are a tool for change, for personal change, and for community change. You can see it in software. It's where all the chemical companies have gone. I've had the great pleasure of doing a little work with DSM, and they have really begun to think about how do we make chemicals a tool for improving the world? How do we move into better nutrition? How do we support the circular economy? How do we think about this not as a commodity? Take the circular economy. Let's talk about that. What is trash? Trash is something we just threw into the bin, someone took away and dropped into a hole. Total commodity service, nothing there. I talk in the book about Erik Osmundsson, who went into that business and in Scandinavia has taken it from just, no, we just dump the stuff in the river or we dump it in the hole, to a high-tech industry where we source raw materials from the waste stream. And we have these huge machines. He has a whole machine where you put a car in at one end and raw materials come out the other end. I mean, how cool is that? So I think this is where modern capitalism goes, is away from commodification towards differentiated high-value products. No reason agriculture can't go there at an accelerating rate.
I would love, thank you. I loved the recycling example. And I would actually haven't had time yet, but I want to dig into that more because I thought it was just so inspiring. But I wanted to get back around the commodity idea. And you shared the specific example of Lipton Tea in the book, where they really shifted it from a tea from a commodity business to a decommoditized business, which supported supply chain resilience and also the farmer profitability and positive environmental income. But what if we got even more audacious and attempted to decommoditize soil instead of waiting for each individual commodity to decommoditize? And I think this would require what you so eloquently wrote about of around architectural innovation versus the incremental innovation that we see today. So I guess my question is how to light up an entire industry's greater imagination.
So I'm an economist. I think the most effective way to light up that collective imagination is a strong business case. And in this case, what I want, please, is some kind of demand signal, some kind of price for carbon. Because when we talk about soil, how do we decommodify soil? We start talking about it as one of the most efficient carbon sinks on the planet. I mean, we already have the technology, or can see it coming, that we could take a bunch of carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into the soil. And we know that, yes, we can decarbonize the world's power systems, we can decarbonize transportation, but we're going to have to pull the gas out of the air if we can. And there are high-tech people working on solutions, fancy machines, but plants do it every day for free. And if we could put that carbon into the soil, that would make a huge difference. So how do we make it the case that every farmer and everyone who works with the farmer is looking at the soil as this incredibly valuable resource? And of course, I could talk more, and I'm sure other guests have, about how soil is this incredibly alive resource that we need to manage for the long term and the risk of topsoil degradation. There's wonderful photographs where it shows you a foot of topsoil and then 10 years later it's 10 inches and 10, and it just goes down over time. And you think like, okay, what happens when we lose the last two? Like, what's the plan? So soil has to be a resource. So I think step one is trying to create that demand signal, persuading the rest of the world essentially to pay farmers to collect that carbon. The second thing I've seen in my work, Renee, is entrepreneurial firms. Large firms have a ton of trouble understanding that there's an architectural systemic change on the horizon. We already talked about Kodak and Nokia and how hard it was for them. And the single entity that really drives change on the ground is the entrepreneurial actors who say, you know, I think there's something here, who have the courage and the vision to walk, to go first. And those early entrants are so important. They demonstrate that it can be done. They begin to build the business model. They paint the picture of what change might look like. And most importantly, they bug the heck out of the established firms. You know, I can give all the lectures I want about how the world is going to change and you have to get ahead of it and blah, 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 blah. It's all blah, blah. But seeing something like, I mean, I'm sure you've talked about this example, but it's just so real and everyone resonates with it. Seeing Impossible Foods be the most successful IPO in the last 20 years, I mean, if 5 years ago I told my innovation colleagues it's going to be plant-based meat, they would have thought I was crazy. And that's a lovely example of how everyone is going like, okay, we had just assumed it was about, you know, animals walking around and eating. We have to gradually transition away from beef. And that's an example of another major systemic change. But again, these entrepreneurial firms that show the way, that they're hugely important.
I'm intrigued by the idea of those future forums for entrepreneurs to play in, right? We have, they are the area to create this innovation. They're the area to look at how to disrupt and change marketplaces. And I always have been looking at this idea of, you know, there is no unfound terra. There is no world of unutilized waste streams. There's no never, never land to put things anymore. And so whether we're talking about food systems or energy production, there's been a movement, especially in the innovation space and the entrepreneurial space, around refinement and mindfulness, more mindfulness, and connecting that to stakeholder and, you know, diverse stakeholder values to that. And I mean, we've seen it in repurposing food. We've seen it in reducing the volumes, the 40% that goes into food waste streams. We've seen it from producing energy from spike times to, you know, the waste energy side to that. But one area that I think could use the most area of interest, or could be the best place, I'd love to get your perspective on this, is water. You know, have water, this is the molecule that sustains us, that is us. This is the thing that is not even given a commodity value in many circumstances. And as it ties into agricultural systems, we often heard the term that 70% of water, fresh water, goes to irrigating crops. I think there's some new models that look at embodied water or virtual water or total footprint of water actually being closer to 92%, which goes into crops. But yet we waste this incredibly vital molecule and resource on antiquated agricultural irrigation approaches. We put thirsty crops in the wrong areas, tapping old aquifer or ancient aquifer systems to grow alfalfa in the deserts of Saudi Arabia or Phoenix, Arizona. We have outdated infrastructure that loses sometimes 50% of total supply due to leakage. And fresh water is, I mean, realistically, or put in terms I think most of our audience can look at, you take potable water and every time you flush the toilet, you send 3 gallons down the drain and put it into a waste stream that is just lost. So how can we take that same idea of creating price signals around fresh water and institute that or use that model for changing our approach to dealing with this precious resource?
So Aaron, I kind of wonder if you ask me a trick question here, because we need to price it. Mm-hmm. I mean, people will pay $3 or $4 for a bottle of fizzy water. They'll pay more than they'll pay for gasoline. But the water comes out of their tap. They somehow expect to be really close to free, and it's not free. Mm. And the effect is, I mean, you've described the enormous distortions. I've heard California's rice and almond suppliers described as people who take the local water, package it up, and ship it to China, you know, yeah. Without charging the right kind of price. So we need to find a way collectively to value this resource. I had the pleasure of doing a small piece of work with Xylem, which is a pump company, historically described itself as a pump company. They are in the midst of a very exciting transition to become a systems company, where instead of we just pump water, we're all about managing, cleaning, monitoring the water system so that it's used much more effectively. And so I think we can see that underway. I want to, though, hook in to something you said I thought was super important, which is you talked about mindfulness. And I think it's sometimes tempting to wait. Oh, we need a price for water, which we absolutely do. We need a major political change, which we absolutely do. But we also need people to be mindful, to be aware of how much this is costing. Because I think where real change comes from is the interaction between the hard work of changing the price signals in the institutions and the soft work of helping people understand why that needs to happen, why it's vital, how it can be done. I mean, what's so crazy about water, if I understand correctly, is we have the technologies. We know how to do this much, much better. So we know how to husband our resources. We just need that push to value it properly, to put all that into place.
Yeah, it's often combining some of those approaches of political influence along with free markets, which I know you talk often within your book. But let me read a bit about your bio so our audience gets an idea, and then we'll jump into the further questions. So Rebecca Henderson is the John and Natty MacArthur University Professor at Harvard University, where she is a joint appointed at the Harvard Business School and the General Management and Strategy Units. Professor Henderson is also the research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. She spent the first 21 years of her career at MIT, as you had mentioned, and much of that Eastern Kodak Professor of Management. She teaches Reimagining Capitalism in an MBA program and sits on the board of Amgen and IDEX Labs. So, Renee, I'll turn it over to you and just cue up to the conversation that I want to get back to this idea, and this is something I want to maybe close with, but I'll hand over to Renee first, of stakeholder value versus shareholder value. And something to think about as we cue it up. But Renee, I know I stepped on your toes a moment ago, so I'm going to turn it over to you first, and then I'll close with that question.
My question was just around, there's a lot of ag industry consolidation, and so there's little competitive pressure to drive change. And so I wonder, leading up to Aaron, your investor question is, how do we engage the investor community around driving the change that's required within this minimally competitive agriculture industry?
I think the investor community could be extraordinarily helpful in helping to drive change. And particular, those investors who are really, really, really rich and have very long time frames. And there are quite a lot of them. In the book, I talk about the Japanese government pension fund, which is the largest pension fund in the world. They own about 7% of the Japanese equity market. They own about 1% of all the other publicly traded firms in the entire world and a bunch of other stuff as well. And what's interesting about the fund as an example is a guy called Hiro Mizuno, who had a long history in private equity and was brought back to the Japanese government pension fund, the GPIF, to try and increase its returns. And he got there a few years ago. He looked around and he said, wait, you're all trying to increase the returns to the money by trying to pick the winner in a particular industry. Like, I'm going to pick Monsanto and not Bayer, say. But that's crazy. We know over time, the research is super clear on this, that nobody picks winners for extended periods of time. Plus, I'm so big that I have to own everything in the world. Technically, I'm a universal owner. I own the universe. I own the entire portfolio. That what's going to drive the returns to my money is not individual firms doing better, it's the whole system doing better. And you know what? The best way to have the whole system do better is to avoid these horrible crashes we've been having. If we could have avoided the 2008 crash, we would have been a lot better off. If we could have avoided or at least mitigated the current pandemic about which we were warned, we would have saved literally trillions of dollars. And he and people like him look at climate change and go, okay, unless we can find a way to change things, the value of my entire portfolio is at risk. Now, of course, you still have a collective action problem because even though Hiro owns, 1% of the world's wealth, which is kind of mind-blowing, he alone can't get people to change. But there are enough people like him. There are enough pension funds, family funds, focused on the long term, worried about the systemic risks, that now they're getting together. I'm part of one of the NGOs series that helped fund an initiative called Climate Action 100. And that's roughly 30% of the world's invested assets. It's trillions of dollars getting together and going to firms and saying, you need to deal with this issue. And we'll make sure that if everyone moves together, so again, back to my old idea, we need to move together so no one's at a competitive disadvantage. If you all take this seriously, we will back you. And in fact, if you don't start taking it seriously, we may vote against you. So I'm sure you saw Larry Fink's recent letter where he said, no, you don't understand. Climate change is a central risk to my customers. If you don't have a plan for dealing with it, if you don't have metrics and measures for how you're going to deal with it, I am going to very seriously consider moving against the management team. It's no coincidence that Hiro Mizuno is Larry Fink's largest customer. So I think investors can play an enormous role. They can go to the agricultural firms. They have the systemic perspective. And they've gone, I think, and this is a major transition. Again, this is an architectural transition for them. This is a very different way of thinking about investing. Instead of pick the good firm, you're now, okay, how do I think about the whole ecosystem? My portfolio is not going to survive unless we can really rebuild the world's agriculture. Okay, who do I lend my money to? Who do I promote? What firms, you know, and I think having the investors on board is going to be huge. Not easy, not immediate, but again, a really plausible route towards doing things in a new way and a real source of hope going forward.
So, Rebecca, I know we only have a few moments here left, but maybe you could speak to, in the book you mentioned often Milton Friedman and that point of view of everything related to the investor being around shareholder value. And the Enlightenment seems to be moving in the direction of stakeholder value. And you mentioned Larry Fink and many of the progressive leaders within the space. So is it just that Friedman had a miscalculation here that we live on and within a finite resource, or was he just the, and I'll say this is a provocative question, was he just the mouth breather, knuckle dragging, old school mentality of I'll take it, I'll grab it, and I'll pull it as much as I can. So I'll turn it over as a final thought, but please let me know your thoughts from that point of view.
That's a very unfair description of Professor Friedman, one of the smartest economists of his time.
Of course. So it's been provocative, of course, Phil.
No, I love it. I love it. So the issue is this. If you have a strong government that's setting appropriate rules on firms, that's making sure that the public goods like decent health and education are provided so that we don't have problems of inequality, and that's making sure that when there's, let me get all technical on you, a negative externality, what do I mean? When you can throw carbon pollution out the window for free, that is priced and controlled. Mm-hmm. When there's a government that has the power and the expertise and the popular support to do that, then it's fine to say to firms, just put your head down and make the money. You know, you need to return to investors. The essence of capitalism is competition and always trying new things to drive up returns. We won't solve the problems we face without that competitive dynamic. So I'm a huge fan of capitalism. But I think capitalism needs to be in balance, that it needs to be one of the legs of the stool, that every healthy society, I'm going to go out on a limb here, but I'm going to say, I think we know from the political science and the development economics that every healthy society has three legs: a really strong private sector, highly competitive, a strong, democratically accountable, transparent government, and a strong civil society. A voice for employees, a sense, a free media, that is that voice of the civil society. And that when society has that, it's not that the three come together and sing kumbaya and love one another right now. No. It's about mutual respect and keeping each other in balance. The old-fashioned phrase is countervailing power. Any source of power out of control is a problem. Government out of control, huge problem. You get fascism or populism. I don't want to go there. Business out of control, you write the rules in your own favor. I mean, if you take shareholder value maximization seriously right now, one of the most effective ways to make money is to go to Washington and lobby for special tax breaks, right, and to keep out entrepreneurs and to say that, you know, carbon isn't true. We don't need a carbon price. That's no way to make money. That's not what Professor Friedman had in mind. What he had in mind is genuine competition. He even says, within the rules of the law and ethical custom. So it's not that we need to throw shareholder value out the window. That would be a mistake. It's, again, it needs to be in balance. It needs to be in balance with understanding that firms don't thrive without society thriving, that without paying attention to stakeholders, you won't get where we need to go. And ultimately, without helping to reimagine government, because we've had 20, 30 years of government as a dirty word. We're seeing in the current moment the price we're paying for that. You have to have a government that can take action, that is responsive, that isn't about one small section of the population, but is about the whole country and the welfare of the whole country. That's what we need. And it's not throwing shareholder value out the window. It's about a balance, about understanding that firms also have a responsibility to the health of the system, to their employees, to their communities, and yes, to the planet where we live.
Tremendous insight. So thank you so much, Professor Henderson, for taking the time to speak with us. Greatly appreciate it. Renee?
Thank you so much, Professor Henderson. Also, just for living with purpose so boldly. It's so inspiring.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm sorry, I tend to get kind of excited. I think this is like we have to do this as soon as we can.
Yeah.
So it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for letting me talk about my work. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for your guidance. And until next time, I'll say take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.